Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Pontiac, Michigan, and joined the Air Force right out of high school as an electronic technician. He became a fighter pilot and was shot down on October 17, 1967, over North Vietnam on his 17th mission. After serving as a prisoner of war for 5.5 years, he was released on March 14, 1973. A true American hero, he's affectionately known as the Digger. His name, Lieutenant Colonel Donald O'Dell, and I'm Jack Crisul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with a true American hero, Lieutenant Colonel Donald Digger O'Dell. Digger, welcome. An honor to have you.
Good evening, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Well, I grew up in Pontiac, Michigan, of course, and graduated from high school there. I spent my younger days fishing and hunting with my grandfather, who was a hunting and fishing guide. Well, what a composite. And obviously I graduated from high school, and not knowing what I wanted to do in life, I thought, well, the best thing for me to do is join the military and do my obligation, and hopefully by the time I get out of the military, I'll know who I want to be or what I want to be. And one thing led to another.
Digger, what are the biggest things you learned from your mom, and what's the biggest things you learned from your dad?
Probably the biggest thing I learned from my mom, or she really, let's say, pressed me on, was politeness. I mean, she was a stickler at that one. My dad was a lot easier going kind of guy, and he was more of you know, let's just have fun kind of thing. So it was a little contrast there, and we had to make sure we didn't mix those two with the wrong person, okay? But my mother was fairly easygoing. My dad was a much more stricter type of a parent. But when he was in good health or in a good mood, he was a lot of fun.
What was it like growing up in Pontiac in the late 40s?
Probably no different than, I think, anywhere else. We did, you know, just the same things that all kids did back there. And we played hockey in the wintertime and baseball in the summertime. And, of course, I started working when I was 12 and a half years old on an apprenticeship, automotive apprenticeship. So I always one of those kids that had to have money in his pocket. If I didn't have any money in my pocket, man, I was lost. So my ambition, when the other kids were out tearing up their cars, I was the kid who was fixing those cars. So,
what'd they pay you a day?
Boy, I don't remember. It wasn't a lot of money, but at least I was saving money, not tearing up a car.
You graduate high school. You enlist in the Air Force. Why the Air Force?
Well, I really wanted to join, be a paratrooper. My older brother was a paratrooper, so, you know, he was almost like God to me. I mean, when he came home in that uniform and all that, you know. But this kid I was joining with, who I chummed with, his name was Gerald Curry in Pontiac there, and he was only 17. So we went to his folks' house one night and to get them to sign that he'd go in the paratroop direction, and they said, absolutely no way. We're not going to sign for you for anything except the Air Force. So he looked at me, and I said, yeah, let's go in the Air Force. And the way we went.
You enter with a high school degree.
Mm-hmm.
You're an enlisted serviceman.
Mm-hmm.
How did you ever get into the U.S. Air Force pilot training program? It wasn't your looks, Digger.
No, definitely not. No. Well, my wife may argue with it, but Anyways, it was a quirk thing because I had to go through the chain of military command, and each one said, looking at the regulation, you have to have 2 years of college. Well, I didn't have 2 years of college, obviously. And the second gentleman I went to was Colonel Jabur. He was the ace from Korea. And I thought, now, there's going to be the sympathetic guy. I thought, some way, somehow, he's going to be able to pull a string here somewhere. But he just blew me away. So I asked to go see the wing commander and talk to him. He got out the same regulation, said, well, you don't have 2 years of college. What? My question to him was, what if I could pass a two-year level college-level entrance exam? And he said, I don't know, but I know Colonel so-and-so, who was in charge of the cadet selection team, which was back then the Aviation Cadet Pilot Training Program before the academy. He called him on the phone, and that colonel said, that question has never, ever been asked that I know about. So I said, I'm going to Washington next week, and I'll ask that question and get back with you. And when he came back, he called and said, if you can pass it, we'll give you a waiver for college.
Robert Schuller has this, the possibility thinker's creed, when faced with a mountain, I will not quit. Yep. I'll go over the mountain, around the mountain, under the mountain, through the mountain. What do you say to a listener tonight who's hearing you can't do it, you can't do it, and there's this special dream they have?
I would say anything is possible. I mean, the old saying is, it's a lot of times we say is not what you know, it's who you know. But in my case, it was the fact that nobody had ever asked that question. And this full colonel who came to Yuma, Arizona, where I was stationed, I met with him that evening, and he was, I guess he was impressed with my desires to become a pilot. And he said, I'll find out. But if I hadn't pursued that, demanding to see the next ranking officer, trying to find a solution to this problem, I would have never got there. Nope.
We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel Donald O'Dell, and when we come back, we'll ask him to share with us October 17th, 1967. And I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with the famous digger, Lieutenant Colonel Donald O'Dell. Lieutenant Colonel, take us back to October 17th, 1967, if you would.
Well, that morning we were late getting out off of the air base in Thailand, and we were striking the Depkal rail yard in North Vietnam. And it's one of those deals. What happens to you is you're anticipating. You're going into a high threat area. There's always the chance. But, I think most of us in that kind of profession, it always happens to the other guy, if you know what I mean. And we rolled in, and nobody had shot a round at us, no serviced air missiles, no anti-aircraft guns. And we rolled in, and there were 16 of us in the strike force. And as soon as I rolled in, I took the first shell, apparently, out of the big anti-aircraft gun we call the Golden BB, because the odds of being hit by an anti-aircraft shell directly is pretty small. But the first round of the flak gun, realized I had taken a severe hit. I could look in my mirrors in the cockpit. I could see the fire, around the back of the aircraft. And I kept trying to get it to fly, and it didn't want to fly, and it finally broke in half behind the cockpit. I got hit about 20,000 feet when I rolled in. And the last time I looked at the altimeter, when I'm falling, I'm tumbling because the airplane broke half by the cockpit. I was going through 2,800 feet, and I thought, I'm not going to survive in this. So I reached down, pulled the ejection handles, and ejected myself out of the cockpit of the airplane. Those things that happen, as soon as that parachute popped open and Man, I thought, boy, am I lucky. You know, I checked myself. I didn't have any broken legs or arms, and I wasn't really down into that rocket seat when it fired, and they say it'll break your legs. Well, for whatever reason, maybe because I didn't have any forward motion, my legs were fine. And I thought, boy, you're lucky, until I looked in all around my, in all directions, and realized everywhere I ever looking at is North Vietnam. And what a sink feeling I had in my stomach at that moment. And looked down on the ground, and I could see I was going to land into a small hamlet, a Vietnamese hamlet. I'd say it probably housed maybe 7,500 people. I did not want to land inside of that little hamlet or village. And so I got my knife out, climbed up the harness, cut some of the shroud lines on the parachute so I could steer it a little bit, and landed just outside the village in the edge of a rice paddy.
It was the 17th of October. It was 17 miles northeast of Hanoi, and it was your 17th mission. Share with us, if you will, the first 24 hours.
Well, first of all, if I ever go to Vegas, I am not betting on 17, I'll say that. Not my lucky number. It was my dad's birthday, too. Immediately, I was captured immediately. I was in what we call the high threat triangle, where the northeast rail lines come in and northwest come in from China into Hanoi. So if you went down in that area, there was no way they were going to attempt to rescue you. I was held during the day. I was displayed out in front of the people, and as the day went by, more and more people showed up, and there were probably 300 people at least there. Just prior to dark, I was given a bowl of rice and a little small vial of water all day. And that evening is when they, by this time I've been threatened quite a few times by the civilians there. And they would be like our civil defense, only they were armed. And they wore the Ho Chi Minh pith jacket, and pith helmet, and jacket. And although they were antiquish weapons, there was no way I was going to challenge them, not having any possibility of being recovered at all. And just before dark, they took me out of the it was a thatched roof, mud hut, dirt floors. And took me out on a vestibule, like, and when I looked out around there, there wasn't a soul there. And I thought, where did all the people go? And I couldn't, it seemed strange. Well, then they blindfolded me. They had stripped me down just to everything except my underwear I had on. And they tied my hands behind my back. And walked me around the corner of the building, and eventually, they took the blindfold off me at that moment. And then when they took the blindfold off, I could see I was going to walk the gauntlet. I mean, the people were lined up on both sides of this little dirt path for maybe 75 yards and a right turn, about maybe another 50 yards to the two-track dirt road there. And during the day, I had prayed to see the military, because I had become concerned that they were going to do me in there. And once I started down that little path, all the Vietnamese got their whacks at me with hoe handles, shovel handles. In fact, one stepped out with a real tall Vietnamese with a hacksaw and proceeded to push my head down and tried to saw my head off. And thank God for the militia behind me, they got him off of me. But when by the time I probably made the 75 yards to the turn, short of that maybe, I've been beaten pretty excessively, and I thought, I'm not going to make it. And I say that's when the Psalms 23rd popped in my mind. Yea, though you may walk alone through the valley of death and all that, I never remembered making the rest of that walk. To this day, I cannot recall that. But, you know, those are things that happen to you that, of course, I had no control over. It became pretty brutal when this truck got there, and they were trying to get me to the truck, and the civilians were trying to do me in at that moment to make sure I didn't get on that truck. So it was quite an experience.
That was followed up with 7 days of torture. They fractured your C4 vertebrae.
Mm-hmm.
How bad of a shape were you in after a week?
Well, that first 7 or 10 days, somewhere in there, they are trying to extract military information from you, autobiographical data. I mean, even down to what kind of sports you participated in college, or high school. How many cars did you have? Where did your father work? How much money did he make? How much life insurance you have? Who's it payable to? I mean, it got down rather detailed. That was a challenge in itself, but when you got with the political interrogator, that it became even more stern. His object was to get you to either verbally confess to being a war criminal or to sign a statement that you were a war criminal. Well, by the time it got to be the seventh day, I probably had slept out of those 7 days, maybe a total of maybe 12 hours. And, you know, you have now been tortured into violating the code of conduct, which says you'll only give name, rank, serial number, date of birth. So you feel like you're a traitor. So you don't really, now you arrive at that mental state where if he kills me, I'm better off because I'm gonna have to answer for what I've done here. And we all know everybody has a different threshold for pain, but he had a pistol in his hand. He would rotate the chamber and pointing it at me, and I told him I wasn't going to sign it, and I'd made up my mind. And whenever you didn't answer his question, somebody would strike you from behind. You always had a guard or two behind you that would strike you with a rifle butt, either in the kidneys or the base of the skull. And he muttered something in Vietnamese, and the guy just hauled off and whacked me with a rifle butt. And turned out later, found out that it had fractured the C4, which caused a partial paralysis. So I think he was intelligent enough. Well, I know he was. I later found out he was educated in Russia and Czechoslovakia, and that he realized he had done major damage to me, and picked up his pencils and his recorder and walked out.
We're talking to the Lieutenant Colonel Donald Digger O'Dell, who then spent 5.5 years in the Hoi Noi Hilton. And I'm Jack Crystal, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Now, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Donald Digger O'Dell, who was 188 pounds when he got shot down. 5.5 years later, 114 pounds. And now he's about 160, a fighting machine, 76 years old, with a 9-year-old son, Digger. Hunter. You're in solitary confinement, Digger, for a week. Then they move you to the zoo. You're partially paralyzed. And your cellmate is a guy named Bob Barnett.
Yes. Well, when they took me to the zoo in an old dilapidated truck and opened the cell door and threw me in there, there were three of them, other prisoners in there. And this Bob Barnett, who I'd known 10 years prior, his first reaction to me was, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "The same thing you're doing here." Well, he realized I'd received some rather severe injuries. You know, what was sort of ironic with the whole thing was, guess what his profession was other than being a fighter pilot? He was a physical therapist. Now, the Vietnamese had no knowledge of that whatsoever. And he started working with me and working my arms and my legs and wouldn't leave me alone. And I got sometimes where I became rather severe with him. You know, just leave me alone. I want to rest. Nope, you're not going to rest. And in 6 months, I was walking. And I would say after I got back to the hospitals here, the military hospital at Wright-Patterson, they said if he hadn't done that then to me, you know, that kind of physical therapy, I probably would not have made it. And so I owe a lot to him, needless to say. And 6 months, I was walking. I was up walking. So
5.5 years as a POW. How did you survive? How did you keep the will to go on?
Well, you know, I've never been a religious man all my life, but I believe in God and I respect God. But I tell you, when you're in that kind of an environment, you need somebody to lean on other than a fellow prisoner. I mean, for your mental being, you've got to place some faith somewhere, and you are looking for all the help you can achieve, you'll get. And you realize how important that faith is to you, even though you may not have been that well of a Christian or maybe a practicing Christian prior. But I realized my day-to-day survival was dependent on him. But most important, I think, is your cellmates, because you're going to have those periods after that many years where you're going to say, I give up. I just can't handle this. And that becomes his job to say, hey, you don't talk like that. You will make it. I will make sure you make it, because a week or two, you're going to do the same thing for him. So it's a two-way street.
I had the honor last year to go to Walter Reed Hospital one day with Brigadier General Jack Nicholson. And we visited with 24 soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan recovering. Everyone that had all their limbs had one goal. Brigadier General, I want to get back with my troop in Afghanistan. You know, there's 24 of us. With my gone, we're down to 21. Anyone that was missing a limb, their goal was to be on that in Germany when their troop landed, to be the first one greeting them at the tarmac. That kinship, that bond, talk to us about that.
Well, you realize, you know, that man that's in that cell block or cell with you, laying on that little bed next to you, really is controlling your well-being as well as you're controlling his. And like I said, you sometimes have to be pulled out by the bootstraps, and that's his job, because 2 weeks, 3 weeks, now I'm going to do the same thing for him. But you learned to respect him very highly. You had a lot of regard for him, because he'd probably give his life for you and you would give your life for him. And so there was that bond and respect for each other that grew deeper and deeper depending how long you were there. And I knew everything about him. I knew how many times he chewed, how many times he sneezed. I knew every time how many times he went to the bathroom. You're only this far apart, you know. And he knew the same about you. But you also respected his little personal space, his 6 feet by 2 feet wide. I mean, and he did you too. I mean, it was not talked about, but it did exist. But you still respect that person's privacy, even though you're still trying to make or help this guy survive this, you know, doing what you can to keep his mental process going. They had complete control of our physical, but we had control of our mental. So that was important to keep that mental process going. If the guy told you a joke, I mean, maybe you live with a guy for 5 years, 6 years, and he told you a joke, and you realize that, hey, guy, you told me that 2 years ago. You never let on that he told you. You laughed, cried, whatever you're supposed to do, because you got to respect that. And he never knew that he probably didn't even remember he told you that joke or that story. I knew a lot about them that probably their wives didn't even know. I know their wives didn't know.
We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel Donald Digger O'Dell, who served as a POW for 5.5 years. Digger, what did they feed you, and was there one meal that you craved?
We ate primarily rice, occasionally raw fish, and I say raw, I mean it is raw. They put it in barrels as little fish, and they walked on it. I mean, they didn't clean them or anything, you know. And I was sitting out in the sun in a hot barrel, and I would say of all the things that I probably ate there, including rats and bugs and stuff, that was one thing I could not eat. I could not eat that fish. But rice, I had lived with a guy who despised rice, and he'd say, I cannot stand this rice. I say, slide it right over here. I'll eat it. I to this day. My wife went shopping yesterday. What'd she buy me? Rice. Yes, it's a true story. I love rice. Most of the guys prior to being released are all talking about, you know, I want a big steak, or I want lobster, you know, this shrimp, whatever it was. My most desired meal was a complete turkey dinner, like Thanksgiving, you know. The turkey, the gravy, the mashed potatoes, you know, and all that, pumpkin pie. And I will say, when we reached the base there in the Philippines, after being released, they had every kind of food that you could think of. I mean, you had your choice of lobster, steak, turkey, chicken, whatever, ribs. I mean, they had everything for us. But you could only eat this much because you just didn't have the capacity in your stomach.
Did you ever doubt or question God?
I might have at the beginning. There's a good possibility I did. But when I walked down that between those Vietnamese, I realized that I wasn't there by myself. Okay, that probably made me mentally realize that, yeah, somebody is helping me, and it has to be God because there is no other creature around me.
We're talking to Donald Digger Odell. And when we come back, this being Valentine's evening, we'll ask him about cherishing each day and each person in life. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to a true American hero, the Digger, Lieutenant Colonel Donald Odell. Lieutenant Colonel, this is Valentine's evening. Talk to us about cherishing each day and cherishing your loved ones.
Well, as I say, probably every friend that I have, and I do have quite a few, that I always say, there's no such thing as a bad day. Not anymore. Just some days are better than others. I think what I really, the greatest impact on me mentally regarding friendships and love and that, is that I looked back on my life and discovered there was a lot of people who probably wanted to be my friend, but I was too busy to recognize that or to accept that. And therefore, they went by the wayside. And I realized after I got back that I had done that. And all I could say, I don't refuse any type of a friendship. I mean, even if it's a short, long, whatever it is. And I probably have a lot more respect for my fellow man. Maybe a little more comprehending of that individual's individualism compared to me, and a lot more, I think, respect for my family, my loved ones. They, too, were instrumental in keeping me going while I was there, because my biggest fear was, if I don't make it, look at the pain I'm going to bring upon them. So that in itself helped me to endure or to withstand it.
You're a POW for 5.5 years, and then March 14th, 1973. Tell about that day.
That was a big day. Although we didn't really believe we were being released. They dressed us up. We were given shoes and pants and a little bag and a jacket and loaded on these buses and taken to Gialam Airport, which is a little dinky, low building there in Hanoi, the capital. And On the way there, they stopped and they gave us some bananas and some fruit. And we still didn't believe it. We had been led to believe on many occasions when things happened that something big was going to happen, and it never happened. And so you get a little burnout, I guess. And we really didn't, even when we got to the airport and they lined us up, we thought, they're going to stop this. I think every one of us had that mental thought. They are going to stop this before it actually happens. And nobody said a word, none of us. Yeah, till the airplane went down the runway and left the ground. And then it was a free-for-all. We realized we were leaving there. And I used to say about my captors, you know, we all ridiculed them, of course. You know, someday we're going to go home and you got to stay in this godforsaken place. It was another relief mentally to endure.
If there's a listener tonight who's been listening to your story and saying, Digger, I'm going through really tough times. I don't think I can make it. I'm thinking about ending it, giving it up. What do you say?
I would say I can't imagine anything being that perplexed or that affecting me that I could ever think that. Did I think that in the prison camp? Yes. When I was going through the torture session, I knew that right there over that table was a light cord with a bear bulb hanging on it. And I thought if they ever press me too far, I could climb up on the table, put that thing around my neck, and jump off. But you got to see, in that case, I thought I was a traitor because I violated that code of conduct. I gave them more than name, rank, serial number, date of birth. In fact, we got that changed after we had got back because nobody can sustain that. We had it changed to you will attempt to give only rather than you will give only. Could I have done it? I don't know that. I would like to think not, but if they would have pressed me for very sensitive information, which I may have had knowledge of, I might have. But I don't think in the regular day-to-day life that we have here, I don't think I could ever reach that mental position where something was that pressing to me that I could end my life. I don't think I could do that. You just have to keep going.
You've given over 1,500 speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points you make is freedom ain't free.
Yes, and that's exactly true. Freedom is not free. And even I did a lot of high schools, and at the end of my presentation, I would tell them, look, I have not been in every country in the world, but I've been to a lot of them. If you find a country that has what we have, including material things, you call me. Here's my phone number. You know what? I will not lay awake at night waiting for your phone call because you are never going to call me. End of conversation.
You're legendary in Macomb, Harrison Township. People love you. They marvel that you've stayed positive, and they especially marvel that you have this great gift of being appreciative. Talk about being appreciative.
Well, I sometimes I'm almost a little bit embarrassed, you know, being called a hero. I mean, I paid my nickel and I took my chances. I ended up in the military, you know, and I ended up in combat. I did what I had to do. I don't necessarily look at myself as being a hero, but and a lot of people will say, I could have never done that. Yes, you could have. Yes, you could have. You put your mind to it. You had no other choices. I mean, you're either going to survive or you're going to fall by the wayside. And when you only have those choices, you'd be amazed what you can do personally to stay alive.
You love the Air Force to this day. and you told me earlier that you would choose to be a fighter pilot again. Why?
Well, my saying is, if I believed in reincarnation, I'd come back as a fighter pilot. I loved the military, the camaraderie, you know, the being with the guys, doing that kind of work or livelihood. It was, in my early days, I used to think I should be paying the government to let me fly this airplane. I mean, it was so much fun. And I just enjoyed it tremendously. And, you know, a lot of us survived there because of your fellow man, that when you got hurt or you were beaten up and all that, that guy was there to talk to you, to help you. And you realized how important that fellow man is to you. Without him, you probably would not have survived.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I would say, when you look to your future, one of the important aspects, as we all know, is education. But if you have a desire to become somebody or some professional person, you can achieve that. I mean, it's going to take some hard work. You're going to have to apply yourself. But don't ever think that you cannot do that. You can gain the strength. You can get help from a lot of friends, family, loved ones, to do what you want to do.
Digger, an honor to meet you, spend time with you. You're what make America great in many, many ways. And you're blessed to have the 9-year-old son, Hunter.
Yep.
But boy, he's blessed to have you as a dad.
You keep me younger longer.
So I hope you spend a lot of time hunting and fishing with him.
We will.
Please join us next Sunday. Happy Valentine's. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.
Believe in yourself.